Welcome back to The Bookshelf. I'm Caleb Mannin, reading my novel, Bust It Like a Mule. The story continues. Chapter 3. Cotton got up the next morning and stretched, feeling a mite better, though his nose sounded like a rusty muffler, and his bones creaked like them pines in the wind. The crows were gone now, and the fire was out, and Cotton followed the road up a piece, and he began to feel a bit of iron fall out of his step until he was whistling in the sun like a regular goddamn Johnny Appleseed, though he had no trees to plant nor reason to plant them. He made it quite a few miles up the road and saw the rail tracks running along the Clark Fork River. So he made camp and hoped to catch the rails further up into the meaty part of Montana. He made himself a fine camp, for he had no idea how long he would have to wait for the next train, and he figured if it showed up too soon to make all his work on his camp for naught, he could just wave it on and catch the next train. That was the beauty of Cotton's life and the beauty of Montana. He dug into his ruck and found him some fishing twine and fishing barbs wrapped around an Oregon yew stick that he'd got from the Oregon coast as a walking stick until he broke it over some Nimrod's skull, and he cast out into the Clark Fork River looking for a bite for lunch. While he's out there fishing, we can rifle through his bag right quick, and you can see that Cotton ain't no thief or bum or beggar or louse, as he's got the possessions that most men have, only he don't have too many of them like most men or the trappings therewith to hang them in. He had some hair cream for his glossy pompadour that he didn't like must, and this is the reason that he didn't wear his engineer cap that the old hoghead who is dead, God rest his soul, give him all that much, although it is one of his prized possessions for when the sun was beating down upon his brow, or when he's fishing like he is now, so that the hat is with him pulled low to cut the sun's sparkle glare off the river. He had an old pig sticker that looked like he had procured it from a leather neck in an Indian leg wrestling match, or maybe he was telling the truth, and he earned that knife by serving Uncle Sam during the war, as he was old enough to have been in the war, of course, though he seems ageless, and on cold nights you think you can spot a small hitch in his giddy-up if you squint real tight, that may be from a grenade, shrapnel, or a Jap bullet. But he's only ever said that once or so when he had too much whiskey, I was told about the knife and being in the war, so maybe it is none of my business. No one could say either way, and no one sure as hell wasn't going to call him a liar, at least not in the presence of aforementioned pig sticker. Well, hell, I guess just not at all, knife or no, for Cotton is a mean buck cuss. He didn't wear the knife on his belt no more like he used to wear a knife on his belt in the old days, because it just called attention to himself, and he'd rather not as he got older. And he didn't care for run-ins with cops and rail yard bulls like he had in the old days just for a scrap. And besides, he didn't need to wear no goddamn knife, for men didn't mess with him none. All the bulls on the railways never bothered Cotton none now, for it just wasn't worth losing an arm or a leg or an eye. So he just put the knife in his bag on his back. In that rucksack, he also had matches and extra t-shirts and socks and drawers and a few jackets and the Indian blanket attached to the bottom proper and an army mess kit complete with steel utensils and an army canteen and canned goods and a tobacco tin with cigarette makings and other odds and ends and maybe some things that Cotton has hidden away. But he had bought all these things with his own cash that he earned from cooking or Forest Service crew or bucking bales or picking fruit or delivering advertisements or working the docks or working in a mill or just tough, hard-ass labor, which Cotton was accustomed to on account of his daddy always telling him that it was a tough road to hoe, so you had to bust it like a mule, and he did. There's no cash in the bag, for Cotton kept his cash, if he had any, in his sock under his beat-up, smooth-worn boots on account of getting robbed by the hobos on his first ride west when they rifled his pack, Cotton picking beggars and looters and thieves with no goddamn class. He was fishing there on the smooth, rolling Clark Fork River when he heard something along the bank behind him, and thinking it was someone coming to steal his rucksack and all his earthly possessions, he turned real quick-like, and he saw a boy watching him. It was an Indian boy, and he came down to Cotton and said, "You can't fish here." And Cotton replied, "The hell I can't." "Are you Indian?" the boy asked. "This is as dark as I'll ever get," Cotton replies, meaning no. "Then you can't fish here. This is Indian land." "All this land they give to you Injuns," Cotton says, looking about at the river and the beautiful banks and the trees and the mountains, and he has seen some Indian land, and it sure as hell don't look like this. "I guess." "Well, don't that beat a hen a wormin," Cotton hollers, which is about as clear as mud to the Indian boy, and me as well for that matter, though by the way he hollers it, it means he'll be damned. "You don't talk like no Injun," says Cotton, and the boy does not know what that means, neither. For Indians just speak like everybody else, don't they? But Cotton is just staring at him, so he replies, "We all go to school." "Even I didn't go to school. Now Injuns are, what's this world coming to? What do you say if I told you I was going to fish here anyhow?" "I'd tell you the police will probably come and take you away." "Well, for Pete's sake, ain't that a fine kettle of fish? Damn me gently, I just want to eat is all. All this land getting cut up like a side of beef with all the fences and zones and counties and reses and such. It's a by God crying shame." And the boy said nothing. "Well, fine then, you smart ass. I will just starve, thanks to you," Cotton said as he reeled in his line. "You don't have to starve," the boy said. "We have food at our house." "I'll be a monkey's uncle," Cotton said. "Why didn't you say so in the first place?" And Cotton followed the boy, feeling like Montana really was the place for him to be. The boy took Cotton to his home, and the Indian family wasn't in colorful blankets nor feathers in their hair, but they wore denim jeans and flannel shirts, and their hair was long, so Cotton figured this was about as good as it could get. He was excited to see what an Indian family would be eating, whether it be trout or venison or maybe bison or rabbit. But come to find out, it was goddamned canned beans, just like Cotton had in his bag, though they made a corn pone that was good, but on the dry side, so it needed molasses, and they didn't have none. But Cotton figured this was the first time he had dined with a native family, and he felt part of something, though they ate in silence and did not speak to him, and neither he them. The Indian father came home late, and he had cheap cans of beer, and I will be jiggered if he did not share them with Cotton while the children played outside with the dogs. "Where are you going?" the Indian father asked of him. "I ain't rightly sure," Cotton replied after a swig of beer. "I guess I'll see it when it sees me. I fancy myself going up to Glacier Park to take a peek at them mountains." The Indian father nodded and says, "The land where the world began." "Is that what they say?" Cotton asks, and the Indian father takes a drink of his beer, then goes, "It is what we say." "Well, then I guess it is a good place for a man who don't know where he belongs now, ain't it?" And Cotton would not have said this to just anybody, but he felt the Indian father understood, especially after the way he had said, "The land where the world began." The Indian father nodded, and Cotton could tell that indeed the Indian father did understand. Cotton stayed on with the Indian family a few days, happier than a hog on ice, just camping out front of their trailer by a fire under the big sky, big stars, and playing with the children and the dogs and drinking beer with Indian father. As I said before, he was no bum or beggar, so he worked for his food and beer by helping Indian father push some rusty hunks of junks of cars off the property over a ledge, while the children watched with serious faces. For they saw Cotton was strong as a by-God bear, for he did not need Indian father to help him lug those cars. He just got behind them and shoved them off the cliff himself, so as Indian father would turn and the job would be done, and he would shake his head, for he had never seen a stronger man nor a white man ever helped him as much. Cotton stayed on like this until he felt bad that he was eating the Indian family out of house and home and drinking all their beer, though he worked for it, for this is just the kind of man he is. So he said he must be headed out, even though he really didn't want to, because he liked that family very much, and began to wish it was his own. But he also knew that this was the biggest reason of all for an old broke-down hobo like himself to get a move on, so he did. chapter 4. The Indian family knew another Indian family that had a broke-down old truck, and they hitched Cotton a ride up to the nearest town, Cotton being in the back of the truck with all the kids and dogs to see him off. An Indian father riding shotgun, for Cotton would not take the seat when Indian father offered it to him. They took him quite a piece up the river and out of Indian land, and when they dropped him at the filling station, Indian father asked of him, "What will you do now?" And Cotton said, "Bust it like a mule." Then they shook hands through the truck window, and all the kids waved and the dogs barked. Then Cotton started walking, and he kept on walking until he reached another broke-down jerkwater town with a shabby main street and an economy about the size of the blade of grass between Cotton's teeth. Now, by about this time, he was tired, and his feet were sore, and it was hotter than old Blicky's under the big sky, big sun. So Cotton decided he needed a cold beer or a hot cup of Joe, but he couldn't decide which because he craved a frosty long neck real bad, but he also liked his hot cup of Joe, and he had learned from the Mexicans who he picked fruit with that if it is hot, you drink coffee because it regulates your bodily temperature or some such thing or other, and he believed it, for them Mexicans, they sure as hell knew about the by God heat. So he stopped in for a hot cup of Joe and some cold water in a little cafe place, even though the locals looked at him sideways like and he didn't care none. He liked Montana, and he thought Montana liked him, and no one could tell him different because that's just the way that man was. While he was sitting sipping his Joe, his mind rolled back like an old musty rug out of the attic to the door of that old homestead in the hills, with his mama's sad eyes and his daddy's eerie guitar broke wailing, and his little brother and his little sisters who were just real little when he left. Being that Cotton was a free spirit, he didn't mind leaving his family and never looking back, but being that he was a man of flesh and blood, he never forgot nor forgave himself that he left his family and never looked back, not on account of his daddy and maybe just a little bit on account of his poor mama, but mainly due to his baby brother and sisters. Some nights he'd have terrible dreams about them and wake up screaming, and all the others around him in the train yard would scatter like mice because they thought the tomcat was powerful angry. And he was, but not at them mice, just at himself and his daddy and maybe his mama a bit. And maybe even though it pains me to say this and I take off my hat as I do the good Lord up above. Whenever you see a man that's angry at the hole in him, you know that that man is angry with God, for that hole in him is where the Holy Spirit sets or don't, if you get my meaning. Now, I ain't saying Cotton was a damnation in the spiritual sense. No, by God, not me. I'd never say that about Cotton. He was a goddamn saint. But I am saying all this just to let you know about Cotton and his innards, the good and the bad, so I told you that. So he sat there drinking his coffee and thinking on his little ones, and he wondered what they were up to these days and where they were, and he wouldn't even know if they was dead or alive, especially his little brother since after the war, because his baby brother was old enough to fight in the war and foolish enough he knew to be a goddang Marine or some other damn fool thing to get himself killed. For those Marines, they were brave, tough sons of bitches, but a lot of them were dead. Also, Cotton had heard that the land he came from in Oklahoma had been put underwater by a dam or a flood or a curse, and that the very spot upon which the old homestead stood was underwater. And although it seemed fitting to drown out such a place as God had drowned out the Badens in the flood, he wondered for his little ones. He thought of his little brother, and he was sad that he had left him all alone like that, and he wasn't sure why he ever did, by God. "Are you okay, mister?" the man running the counter asked of him. "Yes," Cotton replied. "Do I seem un-okay to you?" "Just that you have been sitting here for quite a while staring off into space." "I got a lot to be thinking about." "What's a man with a backpack on his back walking up the highway got to think about besides the sun on his head and wind at his back?" "He's got the wind at his back to think about." The man running the counter scratched his chin, for he knew what Cotton meant by what he said when he said he's got the wind at his back to think about. "Well, I don't know where you come from, mister, but I do know that there is plenty of work in these parts at this time of year. The Forest Service needs labor and maybe even fighting fires, and there's cabins and motels need labor and parks and shops all over. You can get a job up near Glacier Park if you have the mind to. Well, sir, Cotton said as he stood and paid for his coffee with some change, I do have a mind to. Then he was on his way with thanks to the stranger and feeling like Montana really was the place for him. Now, when a man does as much walking as Cotton over the course of his life, he might become uninterested in his surroundings, as they become nothing like the walls of his own house, which he goes through every day and he forgets what's even hanging on them walls. And so it was with Cotton, I guess you could say, that every now and again he had forgotten what was hanging on the walls of his house being the whole outdoors of the West. But it wasn't like that here in Montana, for he felt overtook with all the beauty around him like he had never felt he'd see. All them rising mountains rising up to button up to the sky like great white breasts in a pretty blue blouse, and the river singing like a beautiful girl, and the cows and horses along the quiet stretches of meadow was really more than Cotton could even stand to bear, but he bore it for it was so beautiful. He couldn't remember the last time he'd seen beauty so beautiful, besides that girl Nancy back in Seattle, who had wondrous breasts and hips and danced at night for money and lay with Cotton during the day, this being the reason that he stayed too long in Seattle in the first damn place, and he had busted that banker's nose with a plate for saying his steak was too well done. Maybe he busted that banker's nose with a plate not so much because that banker was ornery, which he was, but because he knew he was sinking in deep with this sexy burlesque Nancy girl, and that that was no good, so he had lit out without even telling her, and he figured it'd break her pointy little heart, but he just couldn't care. He had to do it, and he knew he had to, and he did it, and that's just the way Cotton was once his mind was made up. But all that to say, he'd never seen such beauty as was hanging on these Montana walls, he didn't think. But this beauty did not make him want to run like he ran from that Nancy dancer. It made him want to nestle up in these mountain breasts and settle in the breath of the sweet wind on his cheeks and the blonde-haired sun shining down on him and just lie there and sleep. So Cotton went off the road a piece, and he lay in the blonde-haired sun with his most prized engineer cap pulled low over his eyes, and he sawed logs like Paul Bunyan working on a redwood. His siesta was but short, for he was awoken with a queer sensation of being kissed all over by beautiful dancer girls that loved and took care of him and didn't love no others like him, all of them, all at once. And he sat up and saw that an ornery cuss damn cow had come over and was lapping up on his face like a dog would lap up water on a hot day. And Cotton had to laugh, but he still cussed at that by God cow and told it to get for licking his face like that and giving him dreams of dancers when it couldn't even get him a glass of by God milk. He wiped his face with his most prized possession cap and grinned, and he said, hell, even the cows are rolling out the welcome mat. And he felt mighty full inside, like after you eat a good supper, even though he hadn't had a good supper, and he was getting kind of famished, truth be told, and it was a hell of a far pace to walk to get to the Glacier Park, to the land where the world began, as Indian Father had told him. Chapter 5. Cotton managed to hitch a ride from an old farmer who drove powerful slow in his old truck, so that Cotton wondered why he didn't jump out and run on up ahead. But he was glad for the rest to his legs and lungs, so he just stayed in the cab and rolled a cigarette, and offered one to the farmer, who declined, so Cotton smoked by himself. He didn't mind that the farmer didn't speak, for he didn't speak neither, but felt at peace, just smoking with his arm out the window, watching the land roll by real slow, because the old man was driving so by God slow. After a bit of this slow driving, they came out of farmlands and cattle pasture, right smack dab at the tip of one of the greatest lakes that Cotton had ever laid eyes upon, which Cotton later learned was the largest fresh lake out west, being Flathead Lake, but it used to be called Salish Lake, and both names named after Indian tribes, but Cotton didn't see no Indians. The old farmer did point out that this right here South Lake was some res land, So he took Cotton a little further so he could drop him off with white folk, and Cotton didn't tell him the Indians were his friends, for he knew that the old farmer would not understand it. "This old lake here," the farmer said, and he seemed to be glad to have something to discuss with the smoking stranger with a busted nose as he took him into White County, "is near to 200 miles all the way around when it's said and done." "I'll be hornswoggled," Cotton said. "That's a mighty big lake. Good fishing?" "The best. You got to get licenses for everything nowadays, but it's worth the trouble if you like bull and cutthroat trout." And Cotton admitted that he did indeed love both of them trout, though he could never be sure he'd et one or the other, just trout in general. And in his head, but not aloud, he thought that a license was never worth the trouble. It was just something for the law to hold over your head and when they needed to. Cotton had a car license once down in California, God knows how, but he did. He took the test and all, and later that month, he'd lost it by drinking and driving and crashing, when he crashed clean through a bar, but that never stopped him from driving after that, though it did stop him from owning a car himself. "The Indians own a fair piece of the lake down here," the old farmer went on, "and it's named after them. Used to be Salish Lake, now it's Flathead Lake. Ain't the Salish from out west?" "They sure are, son, you know your geography." And Cotton felt a swelling of pride in his chest for another man, especially an elder one at that, although he be merely a farmer, to tell him he knew something. "They came out here, I guess, maybe because of the treaty and the land," the farmer went on. "It's a fair reservation, although there are some problems, of course." "Problems?" "Poverty and drinking, like normal," the old farmer went on, and Cotton smiled to himself that he was just the same with his poverty and drinking, like normal, and he wasn't even a goddamn Indian. "They shifted all those Indians around, and now you can't tell most tribes from another." Cotton didn't say aloud, just thought that he had been shifted all around and couldn't tell his tribe from any other, just like God's own people in the Old Testament. But he didn't own a scrap of land, so maybe the Indians were a mite better off than him, although being chained to the land was what they were against in the first place, and so was he, so maybe just like he thought before, the Indians really were his friends. The old farmer dropped Cotton off, and Cotton watched him drive back the way they'd came. Then he tracked up the road and looked down on that by-God beautiful Salish Flathead Lake. Cotton hadn't seen anything so beautiful blue since he'd seen that blue-eyed girl waitress down in Arizona who was going to college and working. Man, she was a damn hard worker, as most women usually were, he'd found, especially since after the war, even that Nancy dancer in Seattle, pulling all-night shifts, busting it like a mule. Looking at all that beautiful blue, still lake deeper than God's eye sockets, he had a great sudden sadness fill him at the thought of the lake and God and beautiful women, so much so that he stumbled on a rock, and to make himself feel better, he cursed and threw that damned rock as hard as he could, but it did not make it all the way down to the lake, and his arm was sore for having thrown it so hard for no damn reason, so he cursed some more. Every now and again, as he made his way along the road, he could pick out houses built into the trees, some old houses and some newer fancy types which he didn't care for the look of. He almost wished that he could go back and live on Indian land, but he knew that wasn't where the land where the world began, was it? It was just a sad settling place, so he went on. Cotton made it to a fruit stand right off the road that was built like a red and white barn, and it overlooked a small orchard that overlooked Flathead Lake, with a man and his wife running the place, so he stopped a bit and asked for some water for his canteen, and they obliged mighty nicely, and he got talking with them, and soon he was helping them with some crates of fruit, for which they gave him a nice dinner of venison and buttered taters, all at a picnic table overlooking the orchard that overlooked the lake. And he sat and talked to the man, and the man asked him if he had been in the war, and Cotton said that he had, and the man shook his hand because he had been in the war as well, and come to find out, they had both been in the Pacific at the same time, one doing building with the CBs and one fighting with the Marines, and I won't tell you which is which, 'cause Cotton don't like to talk about it none. The husband and wife let Cotton spend the night in the fruit shed and told him to take all the fruit he wanted, so he took a mess of tomatoes and peaches and apricots, not so many as to come off ungrateful or beggarly. Then he lit out the next morning before the man and his wife was up, and he left them a note that said, "Thank ye for your kindness, Cotton K." And the man put the note in the money box like it was legal tender, and his wife patted him on the back. Cotton didn't know where he was going, and he didn't quite care, though he did a bit in the back of his skull. But he couldn't tell why, like a light bulb with a dangling chain you can't find in the dark. But maybe this is because hobos don't usually wander this far from civilization and the main tracks, and Cotton knew it. All the same, he just felt like something was pulling him along, like the time he'd been in Wyoming, wrestling cattle, and he had this lariat, and he tied it around the bull's neck. But the bull broke loose, and Cotton's foot got stuck in the rope, and he got dragged across the damn yard with the other men laughing and he cussing and hollering to raise up the dead. And when he broke free, he punched the bull in the head, and they say it knocked the poor beast clean out. Then he went around and beat up the men that laughed at him, and the boss fired him but gave him a couple weeks' wages for a good show. That's how he felt he was being dragged so far from his beaten path, was like by that bull. And every now and again he'd look up to see if someone was laughing at him, but they wasn't, and it was okay, and he didn't have to be so damn mad. So he drug on through a few small towns until he met the end of Flathead Lake, which is the northern end, and he was so sad to part with it that he made camp at the end of the lake near the beginning of a small town, and he camped under the biggest sky he had camped under in all his dang life. The only thing that made the parting with the lake and all its beautiful blue spirits bearable was the biggest by God mountains on either side of him rising up like angels' alamos to keep out evil spirits, which Cotton later learned was the Swan Mountains. The Swan Mountains went up like a mighty fortress that is our God, and Cotton was betwixt them, and he felt safe, and like it really was the land where the world began, for God must have spent an awful lot of time here making it. And this made him think of God, and he prayed, even though he took the Lord's name in vain about 100 times a day. He prayed, because he felt like he was in church, and the stained glass nature windows hanging on these walls were spilling out their beautiful light on him, and when he prayed, he knew he wasn't as tough as he used to be, and that scared him, which made him mad, because Cotton didn't get scared. But then he figured even a man as tough as he could get a little fear in him when it came to the man upstairs. He reckoned getting a little fear of the Lord in him would be okay out here, all alone in the wilderness, with no wild women nor men trying to prove he wasn't something on a stick when right now he was not. He didn't even know what he was praying for, just checking in, he guessed, because he couldn't remember the last time he'd checked in. He didn't get on his knees and fold his hands as much as he sat on his ass and smoked a cigarette and inhaled the smoke like it was the Holy Spirit. And he just thought them tobacco thoughts to God, and he knew that this is how the Indians would do it, and now he knew why they really smoked them peace pipes it was for to talk to God. Then Cotton set out straight toward the mountain's pulp, and there could be no mistaking that he knew where he was going now. He was going into the heart of them mountains and the meaty part of this place, like a hunter's bullet goes into a deer, or like a man is drugged behind an angry bull, to the place where he must knock that angry bull out with his fists while the others stand around laughing. You've been listening to Busted Like a Mule, written and read by me, Caleb Bannon. It was recorded and edited by Mike Aylman as well as Vern Windham, who produced it for Spokane Public Radio.